protecting your father now. You might as well help us, and there will be no charges against you. You shouldn't lie to children, I yelled, hoping my voice carried all the way downstairs. Carter would never say a word against Dad, and neither will I. The inspector didn't even have the decency to look embarrassed. He crossed his arms.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Sadie. I'm afraid it's time we went downstairs to discuss consequences with your grandparents.
4. Kidnapped by a not-so-stranger. I just love family meetings. Very cosy, with the Christmas garlands round the fireplace and a nice pot of tea and a detective from Scotland Yard ready to arrest you. Carter slumped on the sofa, cradling Dad's work bag. I wondered why the police had let him keep it. It should have been evidence or something, but the inspector didn't seem to notice it at all. Carter looked awful. I mean, even worse than usual. Honestly, the boy had never been in a proper school, and he dressed like a junior professor with his khaki trousers and button-down shirt and loafers. He's not bad-looking, I suppose. He's reasonably tall and fit, and his hair isn't hopeless. He's got Dad's eyes, and my mates Liz and Emma have even told me from his picture that he's hot, which I must take with a grain of salt, because A, he's my brother, and B, my mates are a bit crazed. When it came to clothes, Carter wouldn't have known hot if it bit him on the bum. Oh, don't look at me like that, Carter. You know it's true. At any rate, I shouldn't have been too hard on him. He was taking Dad's disappearance even worse than I was. Gran and Gramp sat on either side of him, looking quite nervous. The pot of tea and a plate of biscuits sat on the table, but no one was having any. Chief Inspector Williams ordered me into the only free chair. Then he paced in front of the fireplace, importantly. 2 more police stood by the front door, the woman from earlier and a big bloke who kept eyeing the biscuits.
"Mr. and Mrs. Fast," Inspector Williams said, "I'm afraid we have 2 uncooperative children."
Gran fidgeted with the trim of her dress. It's hard to believe she's related to Mum. Gran is frail and colourless, like a stick person, really, while Mum in the photos always looked so happy and full of life.
"They're just children," she managed. "Surely you can't blame them."
"Pah!" Gramp said. "This is ridiculous, Inspector. They aren't responsible."
Gramps is a former rugby player. He has beefy arms, a belly much too big for his shirt, and eyes sunk deep in his face as if someone had punched them. Well, actually, Dad had punched them years ago, but that's another story. Gramps is quite scary-looking. Usually people got out of his way, but Inspector Williams didn't seem impressed.
"Mr. Fast," he said, "what do you imagine the morning headlines will read? British Museum attacked, Rosetta Stone destroyed." "Your son-in-law, former son-in-law," Gramps corrected, "was most likely vaporised in the explosion, or he ran off, in which case..."
"He didn't run off," I shouted.
"We need to know where he is," the inspector continued, "and the only witnesses, your grandchildren, refused to tell me the truth."
"We did tell you the truth," Carter said. "Dad isn't dead. He sank through the floor."
Inspector Williams glanced at Gramps as if to say, "There, you see." Then he turned to Carter.
"Young man, your father has committed a criminal act. He's left you behind to deal with the consequences."
"That's not true," I snapped, my voice trembling with rage. I couldn't believe Dad would intentionally leave us at the mercy of police, of course. But the idea of him abandoning me, well, as I might have mentioned, that's a bit of a sore point.
"Dear, please," Gran told me. "The inspector's only doing his job."
"Badly," I said.
"Let's all have some tea," Gran suggested.
"No,"
Carter and I yelled at once, which made me feel bad for Gran as she practically wilted into the sofa.
"We can charge you," the inspector warned, turning on me. "We can and we will."
He froze. Then he blinked several times as if he'd forgotten what he was doing. Gramps frowned.
Inspector?
Yes,
Chief Inspector Williams murmured dreamily. He reached in his pocket and took out a little blue booklet, an American passport. He threw it in Carter's lap.
"You're being deported," the inspector announced. "You're to leave the country within 24 hours. If we need to question you further, you'll be contacted through the FBI.
Carter's mouth fell open. He looked at me, and I knew I wasn't imagining how odd this was. The inspector had completely changed direction. He'd been about to arrest us, I was sure of it. And then, out of the blue, he was deporting Carter. Even the other police officers looked confused. "Sir?" the policewoman asked. "Are you sure?"
"Quiet, Lindley. The two of you may go."
The cops hesitated until Williams made a shooing motion with his hand. Then they left, closing the door behind them.
"Hold on," Carter said. "My father's disappeared and you want me to leave the country?" "Your father is either dead or a fugitive, son," the inspector said. "Deportation is the kindest option. It's already been arranged."
"With whom?" Gramps demanded. "Who authorized this?"
"With..."
the inspector got that funny blank look again.
"With the proper authorities. Believe me, it's better than prison."
Carter looked too devastated to speak, but before I could feel sorry for him, Inspector Williams turned to me.
"You too, miss."
He might as well have hit me with a sledgehammer.
"You're deporting me?" I asked. "I live here."
"You're an American citizen, and under the circumstances it's best for you to return home."
I just stared at him. I couldn't remember any home except this flat. My mates at school, my room, everything I knew was here. "Where am I supposed to go?"
"Inspector," Gran said, her voice trembling, "this isn't fair. I can't believe..."
"I'll give you some time to say goodbye," the inspector interrupted.
Then he frowned, as if baffled by his own actions.
I must be going."
This made no sense, and the inspector seemed to realize it, but he walked to the front door anyway. When he opened it, I almost jumped out of my chair, because the man in black, Amos, was standing there. He'd lost his trench coat and hat somewhere, but was still wearing the same pinstripe suit and round glasses. His braided hair glittered with gold beads. I thought the inspector would say something or express surprise, but he didn't even acknowledge Amos. He walked right past him and into the night. Amos came inside and closed the door. Gran and Gramps stood up.
"You," Gramps growled. "I should have known. If I was younger, I would beat you to a pulp."
"Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Faust,"
Amos said. He looked at Carter and me as if we were problems to be solved.
"It's time we had a talk."
Amos made himself right at home. He flopped onto the sofa and poured himself tea. He munched on a biscuit, which was quite dangerous because Gran's biscuits are horrid. I thought Gramps' head would explode. His face went bright red. He came up behind Amos and raised his hand as if he were about to smack him, but Amos kept munching his biscuit.
"Please sit down," he told us.
And we all sat. It was the strangest thing, as if we'd been waiting for his order. Even Gramps dropped his hand and moved round the sofa. He sat next to Amos with a disgusted sigh. Amos sipped his tea and regarded me with some displeasure. That wasn't fair, I thought. I didn't look that bad, considering what we'd been through. Then he looked at Carter and grunted.
"Terrible timing," he muttered. "But there's no other way. They'll have to come with me."
"Excuse me," I said. "I'm not going anywhere with some strange man with biscuit on his face." He did, in fact, have biscuit crumbs on his face, but he apparently didn't care, as he didn't bother to check.
"I'm no stranger, Sadie," he said. "Don't you remember?"
It was creepy hearing him talk to me in such a familiar way. I felt I should know him. I looked at Carter, but he seemed just as mystified as I was.
"No, Amos," Gran said, trembling. "You can't take Sadie. We had an agreement."
"Julius broke that agreement tonight," Amos said. You know you can't care for Sadie anymore. Not after what's happened. Their only chance is to come with me.
Why should we come anywhere with you? Carter asked. You almost got in a fight with Dad.
Amos looked at the work bag in Carter's lap.
I see you kept your father's bag. That's good. You'll need it. As for getting into fights, Julius and I did that quite a lot. If you didn't notice, Carter, I was trying to stop him from doing something rash. If he'd listened to me, we wouldn't be in this situation.
I had no idea what he was on about, but Gramps apparently understood.
You and your superstitions, he said. I told you we want none of it.
Amos pointed to the black patio. Through the glass doors, you could see the lights shining on the Thames. It was quite a nice view at night, when you couldn't notice how run down some of the buildings were.
Superstition, is it? Amos asked. And yet you found a place to live on the east bank of the river.
Gramps turned even redder.
That was Ruby's idea. Thought he would protect us. But she was wrong about many things, wasn't she? She trusted Julius and you, for one.
Amos looked unfazed. He smelled interesting, like old-timey spices, copal and amber, like the incense shops in Covent Garden. He finished his tea and looked straight at Gran.
Mrs. Faust, you know what's begun. The police are the least of your worries.
Gran swallowed.
You changed that inspector's mind. You made him deport Sadie.
It was that or see the children arrested,
Amos said. Hang on, I said.
You changed Inspector Williams's mind? How?
Amos shrugged.
It's not permanent. In fact, we should get to New York in the next hour or so before Inspector Williams begins to wonder why he let you go.
Carter laughed incredulously.
You can't get to New York from London in an hour. Not even the fastest plane.
No, Amos agreed. Not a plane.
He turned back to Gran as if everything had been settled.
Mrs. Faust, Carter and Sadie have only one safe option. You know that. They'll come to the mansion in Brooklyn. I can protect them there.
You've got a mansion? Carter said. In Brooklyn. Amos gave him an amused smile.
The family mansion. You'll be safe there.
But our dad
is beyond your help for now,
Amos said sadly.
I'm sorry, Carter. I'll explain later. But Julius would want you to be safe. For that, we must move quickly. I'm afraid I'm all you've got.
That was a bit harsh, I thought. Carter glanced at Gran and Gramps. Then he nodded glumly. He knew that they didn't want him around. He'd always reminded them of our dad. And yes, it was a stupid reason not to take in your grandson, but there you are. Well, Carter can do what he wants, I said, but I live here, and I'm not going off with some stranger, am I? I looked at Gran for support, but she was staring at the lace doilies on the table as if they were suddenly quite interesting. Gramps, surely, but he wouldn't meet my eyes either. He turned to Amos.
You can get them out of the country?
Hang on, I protested. Amos stood and wiped the crumbs off his jacket. He walked to the patio doors and stared out at the river.
The police will be back soon. Tell them anything you like. They won't find us.
You're going to kidnap us? I asked, stunned. I looked at Carter. Do you believe this?
Carter shouldered the work bag. Then he stood like he was ready to go.
Possibly he just wanted to be out of Gran and Gramps' flat.
How do you plan to get to New York in an hour? He asked Amos. You said, not a plane.
No, Amos agreed.
He put his finger to the window and traced something in the condensation, another bloody hieroglyph. A boat, I said, then realized I'd translated aloud, which I wasn't supposed to be able to do. Amos peered at me over the top of his round glasses.
How did you...
I mean, that last bit looks like a boat, I blurted out. But that can't be what you mean. That's ridiculous.
Look, Carter cried.
I pressed in next to him at the patio doors. Down at the quayside, a boat was docked. But not a regular boat, mind you.
It was an Egyptian reed boat with two torches burning in the front and a big rudder in the back. A figure in a black trench coat and hat, possibly Amos's, stood at the tiller. I'll admit, for once, I was at a loss for words.
We're going in that? Carter said.
To Brooklyn.
We'd better get started,
Amos said. I whirled back to my grandmother. Gran, please! She brushed a tear from her cheek. It's for the best, my dear. You should take Muffin.
Ah, yes, Amos said. We can't forget the cat.
He turned toward the stairs. As if on cue, Muffin raced down in a leopard-spotted streak and leaped into my arms. She never does that. Who are you? I asked Amos. It was clear I was running out of options, but I at least wanted answers. We can't just go off with some stranger.
I'm not a stranger.
Amos smiled at me.
I'm family.
And suddenly I remembered his face, smiling down at me, saying, Happy birthday, Sadie. A memory so distant I'd almost forgotten. Uncle Amos? I asked hazily.
That's right, Sadie, he said. I'm Julius's brother. Now come along. We have a long way to go.
5. We meet the monkey. It's Carter again. Sorry. We had to turn off the tape for a while because we were being followed, but... Well, we'll get to that later. Sadie was telling you how we left London, right? So, anyway, we followed Amos down to the weird boat docked at the quayside. I cradled Dad's work bag under my arm. I still couldn't believe he was gone. I felt guilty leaving London without him, but I believed Amos about one thing. Right now, Dad was beyond our help. I didn't trust Amos, but I figured if I wanted to find out what had happened to Dad, I was going to have to go along with him. He was the only one who seemed to know anything. Amos stepped aboard the reed boat. Sadie jumped right on, but I hesitated. I'd seen boats like this on the Nile before, and they never seemed very sturdy. It was basically woven together from coils of plant fiber, like a giant floating rug. I figured the torches at the front couldn't be a good idea, because if we didn't sink, we'd burn. At the back, the tiller was manned by a little guy wearing Amos's black trench coat and hat. The hat was shoved down on his head so I couldn't see his face. His hands and feet were lost in the folds of the coat. "How does this thing move?" I asked Amos. "You've got no sail."
"Trust me." Amos offered me a hand. The night was cold, but when I stepped on board, I suddenly felt warmer, as if the torchlight were casting a protective glow over us. In the middle of the boat was a hut made from woven mats. From Sadie's arms, Muffin sniffed at it and growled.
"Take a seat inside," Amos suggested. "The trip might be a little rough."
"I'll stand, thanks."
Sadie nodded at the little guy in back.
"Who's your driver?"
Amos acted as if he hadn't heard the question.
"Hang on, everyone."
He nodded to the steersman and the boat lurched forward. The feeling was hard to describe. You know that tingle in the pit of your stomach when you're on a roller coaster and it goes into free fall? It was kind of like that, except we weren't falling and the feeling didn't go away. The boat moved with astounding speed. The lights of the city blurred, then were swallowed in a thick fog. Strange sounds echoed in the dark, slithering and hissing, distant screams, voices whispering in languages I didn't understand. The tingling turned to nausea. The sounds got louder, until I was about to scream myself. Then suddenly the boat slowed. The noises stopped, and the fog dissipated. City lights came back, brighter than before. Above us loomed a bridge, much taller than any bridge in London. My stomach did a slow roll. To the left, I saw a familiar skyline. The Chrysler Building, the Empire State Building. "Impossible," I said. "That's New York." Sadie looked as green as I felt. She was still cradling Muffin, whose eyes were closed. The cat seemed to be purring.
"It can't be," Sadie said. We only traveled a few minutes.
And yet here we were, sailing up the East River, right under the Williamsburg Bridge. We glided to a stop next to a small dock on the Brooklyn side of the river. In front of us was an industrial yard filled with piles of scrap metal and old construction equipment. In the center of it all, right at the water's edge, rose a huge factory warehouse heavily painted with graffiti, the windows boarded up.
That is not a mansion, Sadie said.
Her powers of perception are really amazing.
Look again.
Amos pointed to the top of the building.
How did you...
My voice failed me. I wasn't sure why I hadn't seen it before, but now it was obvious. A 5-story mansion perched on the roof of the warehouse, like another layer of a cake. You couldn't build a mansion up there.
Long story, Amos said, but we needed a private location.
And is this the East Shore? Sadie asked. You said something about that in London. My grandparents living on the East Shore.
Amos smiled.
Yes, very good, Sadie. In ancient times, the east bank of the Nile was always the side of the living, the side where the sun rises. The dead were buried west of the river. It was considered bad luck, even dangerous, to live there. The tradition is still strong among our people.
Our people? I asked, but Sadie muscled in with another question.
So you can't live in Manhattan? She asked.
Amos's brow furrowed as he looked across at the Empire State Building.
Manhattan has other problems, other gods. It's best we stay separate.
Other what? Sadie demanded.
Nothing.
Amos walked past us to the steersman. He plucked off the man's hat and coat, and there was no one underneath. The steersman simply wasn't there. Amos put on his fedora, folded his coat over his arm, then waved toward a metal staircase that wound all the way up the side of the warehouse to the mansion on the roof.
All ashore, he said, and welcome to the 21st Nome.
Nome? I asked, as we followed him up the stairs. Like those little runty guys?
Heavens, no, Amos said. I hate gnomes. They smell horrible.
But you said gnome, N-O-M-E, as in a district, a region.
The term is from ancient times, when Egypt was divided into 42 provinces. Today the system is a little different. We've gone global. The world is divided into 360 gnomes. Egypt, of course, is the first. Greater New York is the 21st.
Sadie glanced at me and twirled her finger around her temple.
No, Sadie, Amos said without looking back. I'm not crazy. There's much you need to learn.
We reached the top of the stairs. Looking up at the mansion, it was hard to understand what I was seeing. The house was at least 50 feet tall, built of enormous limestone blocks and steel-framed windows. There were hieroglyphs engraved around the windows, and the walls were lit up so the place looked like a cross between a modern museum and an ancient temple. But the weirdest thing was that if I glanced away, the whole building seemed to disappear. I tried it several times, just to be sure. If I looked for the mansion from the corner of my eye, it wasn't there. I had to force my eyes to refocus on it, and even that took a lot of willpower. Amos stopped before the entrance, which was the size of a garage door, a dark, heavy square of timber with no visible handle or lock.
Carter, after you. How do you think?
Great, another mystery. I was about to suggest we ram Amos's head against it and see if that worked. Then I looked at the door again, and I had the strangest feeling. I stretched out my arm. Slowly, without touching the door, I raised my hand, and the door followed my movement, sliding upward until it disappeared into the ceiling. Sadie looked stunned.
How?
I don't know, I admitted, a little embarrassed. Motion sensor, maybe.
Interesting.
Amos sounded a little troubled. Not the way I would have done it, but very good. Remarkably good. Thanks, I think. Sadie tried to go inside first, but as soon as she stepped on the threshold, Muffin wailed and almost clawed her way out of Sadie's arms. Sadie stumbled backward.
What was that about, Cat?
Oh, of course, Amos said. My apologies. He put his hand on the cat's head and said very formally, You may enter. The cat needs permission? I asked. Special circumstances, Amos said, which wasn't much of an explanation, but he walked inside without saying another word. We followed, and this time Muffin stayed quiet. Oh, my God! Sadie's jaw dropped. She craned her neck to look at the ceiling, and I thought the gum might fall out of her mouth. Yes, Amos said, this is the Great Room. I could see why he called it that. The cedar-beamed ceiling was 4 stories high, held up by carved stone pillars engraved with hieroglyphs. A weird assortment of musical instruments and ancient Egyptian weapons decorated the walls. 3 levels of balconies ringed the room, with rows of doors all looking out on the main area. The fireplace was big enough to park a car in, with a plasma screen TV above the mantel and massive leather sofas on either side. On the floor was a snakeskin rug, except it was 40 feet long and 15 feet wide, bigger than any snake. Outside, through glass walls, I could see the terrace that wrapped around the house. It had a swimming pool, a dining area, and a blazing fire pit. And at the far end of the great room was a set of double doors marked with the Eye of Horus and chained with 6 padlocks. I wondered what could possibly be behind them. But the real showstopper was the statue in the center of the great room. It was 30 tall, made of black marble. I could tell it was of an Egyptian god because the figure had a human body and an animal's head, like a stork or a crane with a long neck and a really long beak. The god was dressed ancient style, in a kilt, sash, and neck collar. He held a scribe stylus in one hand and an open scroll in the other, as if he had just written the hieroglyphs inscribed there, an ankh, the Egyptian looped cross with a rectangle traced around its top.
That's it, Sadie exclaimed. Per Ankh.
I stared at her in disbelief. All right, how can you read that?
I don't know, she said. But it's obvious, isn't it? The top one is shaped like the floor plan of a house.
How did you get that? It's just a box. The thing was, she was right. I recognized the symbol, and it was supposed to be a simplified picture of a house with a doorway, but that wouldn't be obvious to most people, especially people named Sadie. Yet she looked absolutely positive.
It's a house, she insisted. And the bottom picture is the Ankh, the symbol for life. Per Ankh, the house of life.
Very good, Sadie. Amos looked impressed. And this is a statue of the only god still allowed in the house of life. At least, normally. Do you recognize him, Carter? Just then it clicked. The bird was an ibis, an Egyptian river bird. Thoth, I said. The god of knowledge. He invented writing. Indeed, Amos said.
Why the animal heads? Sadie asked. All these Egyptian gods have animal heads. They look so silly.
They don't normally appear that way, Amos said. Not in real life. Real life? I asked. Come on. You sound like you've met them in person. Amos's expression didn't reassure me. He looked as if he were remembering something unpleasant. The gods could appear in many forms, usually fully human or fully animal, but occasionally as a hybrid form like this. They are primal forces, you understand, a sort of bridge between humanity and nature. They're depicted with animal heads to show that they exist in 2 different worlds at once. Do you understand?
Not even a little, Sadie said.
Amos didn't sound surprised. Yes, we have much training to do. At any rate, the god before you, Toth, founded the House of Life, for which this mansion is the regional headquarters. Or at least, it used to be. I'm the only member left in the 21st Nome. Or I was, until you two came along.
Hang on. I had so many questions, I could hardly think where to start. What is the House of Life? Why is Toth the only god allowed here? And why are you...
Carter, I understand how you feel. Amos smiled sympathetically. But these things are better discussed in daylight. You need to get some sleep, and I don't want you to have nightmares.
You think I can sleep?
Muffin stretched in Sadie's arms and let loose a huge yawn. Amos clapped his hands.
Hufu!
I thought he'd sneezed because Hufu is a weird name, but then a little dude about 3 feet tall with gold fur and a purple shirt came clambering down the stairs. It took me a second to realize it was a baboon wearing an L.A. Lakers jersey. The baboon did a flip and landed in front of us. He showed off his fangs and made a sound that was half roar, half belch. His breath smelled like nacho-flavored Doritos. All I could think to say was, "The Lakers are my home team!" The baboon slapped his head with both hands and belched again.
"Oh, Hufu likes you," Amos said. "You'll get along famously."
"Right." Sadie looked dazed. "You've got a monkey butler. Why not?"
Muffin purred in Sadie's arms as if the baboon didn't bother her at all.
"Ugh!"
Hufu grunted at me. Amos chuckled.
"He wants to go one-on-one with you, Carter, to, see your game."
I shifted from foot to foot. Yeah, sure. Maybe tomorrow. But how can you understand...
"Carter, I'm afraid you'll have a lot to get used to," Amos said. "But if you're going to survive and save your father, you have to get some rest."
"Sorry," Sadie said. "Did you say survive and save our father? Could you expand on that?"
"Tomorrow," Amos said, "we'll begin your orientation in the morning. Hufu, show them to their rooms, please."
The baboon grunted. He turned and waddled up the stairs. Unfortunately, the Lakers jersey didn't completely cover his multicolored rear. We were about to follow when Amos said, "Carter, the work bag, please. It's best if I lock it in the library." I hesitated. I'd almost forgotten the bag on my shoulder, but it was all I had left of my father. I didn't even have our luggage because it was still locked up at the British Museum. Honestly, I'd been surprised that the police hadn't taken the work bag, too, but none of them seemed to notice it.
"You'll get it back," Amos promised, "when the time is right."
He asked nicely enough, but something in his eyes told me that I really didn't have a choice. I handed over the bag. Amos took it gingerly, as if it were full of explosives.
"See you in the morning."
He turned and strode toward the chained-up doors. They unlatched themselves and opened just enough for Amos to slip through without showing us anything on the other side. Then the chains locked again behind him. I looked at Sadie, unsure what to do. Staying by ourselves in the great room with the creepy statue of Toth didn't seem like much fun, so we followed Hufu up the stairs. Sadie and I got adjoining rooms on the third floor, and I've got to admit, they were way cooler than any place I'd ever stayed before. I had my own kitchenette, fully stocked with my favorite snacks. Ginger ale... No, Sadie, it's not an old person's soda. Be quiet. Twix and Skittles. It seemed impossible. How did Amos know what I liked? The TV, computer, and stereo system were totally high-tech. The bathroom was stocked with my regular brand of toothpaste, deodorant, everything. The king-size bed was awesome, too, though the pillow was a little strange. Instead of a cloth pillow, it was an ivory headrest like I'd seen in Egyptian tombs. It was decorated with lions and, of course, more hieroglyphs. The room even had a deck that looked out on New York Harbor, with views of Manhattan and the Statue of Liberty in the distance. But the sliding glass doors were locked shut somehow. That was my first indication that something was wrong. I turned to look for Hufu, but he was gone. The door to my room was shut. I tried to open it, but it was locked. A muffled voice came from the next room. Carter? Sadie. I tried the door to her adjoining room, but it was locked too.
We're prisoners, she said. Do you think Amos, I mean, can we trust him?
After all I'd seen today, I didn't trust anything, but I could hear the fear in Sadie's voice. It triggered an unfamiliar feeling in me, like I needed to reassure her. The idea seemed ridiculous. Sadie had always seemed so much braver than me, doing what she wanted, never caring about the consequences. I was the one who got scared. But right now, I felt like I needed to play a role I hadn't played in a long, long time. Big brother. It'll be okay. I tried to sound confident. Look, if Amos wanted to hurt us, he could have done it by now. Try to get some sleep.
Carter?
Yeah?
It was magic, wasn't it? What happened to Dad at the museum? Amos's boat? This house? All of it's magic.
I think so. I could hear her sigh.
Good. At least I'm not going mad.
Don't let the bedbugs bite, I called. And I realized I hadn't said that to Sadie since we had lived together in Los Angeles, when Mom was still alive.
I miss Dad, she said. I hardly ever saw him, I know. But I miss him.
My eyes got a little teary, but I took a deep breath. I was not going to go all week. Sadie needed me. Dad needed us. We'll find him, I told her. Pleasant dreams. I listened, but the only thing I heard was Muffin meowing and scampering around, exploring her new space. At least she didn't seem unhappy. I got ready for bed and crawled in. The covers were comfortable and warm, but the pillow was just too weird. It gave me neck cramps, so I put it on the floor and went to sleep without it. My first big mistake. 6. Breakfast with a crocodile. How to describe it? Not a nightmare. It was much more real and frightening. As I slept, I felt myself go weightless. I drifted up, turned, and saw my own sleeping form below. I'm dying, I thought. But that wasn't it either. I wasn't a ghost. I had a new shimmering golden form with wings instead of arms. I was some kind of bird. No, Sadie, not a chicken. Will you let me tell the story, please? I knew I wasn't dreaming, because I don't dream in color. I certainly don't dream in all five senses. The room smelled faintly of jasmine. I could hear the carbonation bubbles pinging in the can of ginger ale I'd opened on my nightstand. I could feel a cold wind ruffling through my feathers, and I realized the windows were open. I didn't want to leave, but a strong current pulled me out of the room like a leaf in a storm. The lights of the mansion faded below me. The skyline of New York blurred and disappeared. I shot through the mist and darkness, strange voices whispering all around me. My stomach tingled as it had earlier that night on Amos's barge. Then the mist cleared, and I was in a different place. I floated above a barren mountain. Far below, a grid of city lights stretched across the valley floor. Definitely not New York. It was nighttime, but I could tell I was in the desert. The wind was so dry, the skin on my face was like paper. And I know that doesn't make sense, but my face felt like my normal face, as if that part of me hadn't transformed into a bird. Fine, Sadie. Call me the Carter-headed chicken. Happy? Below me on a ridge stood two figures. They didn't seem to notice me, and I realized I wasn't glowing anymore. In fact, I was pretty much invisible, floating in the darkness. I couldn't make out the two figures clearly, except to recognize that they weren't human. Staring harder, I could see that one was short, squat, and hairless, with slimy skin that glistened in the starlight, like an amphibian standing on its hind legs. The other was tall and scarecrow skinny, with rooster claws instead of feet. I couldn't see his face very well, but it looked red and moist and... well, let's just say I was glad I couldn't see it better.
Where is he?
The toady-looking one croaked nervously. Hasn't taken a permanent host yet. The rooster-footed guy chided.
He can only appear for a short time.
You sure this is the place?
Yes, fool. He'll be here as soon...
A fiery form appeared on the ridge. The two creatures fell to the ground, groveling in the dirt, and I prayed like crazy that I really was invisible.
My lord,
the toad said. Even in the dark, the newcomer was hard to see, just the silhouette of a man outlined in flames.
What do they call this place?
The man asked. And as soon as he spoke, I knew for sure he was the guy who'd attacked my dad at the British Museum. All the fear I'd felt at the museum came rushing back, paralyzing me. I remembered trying to pick up that stupid rock to throw, but I hadn't been able to do even that. I'd completely failed my dad.
My lord,
Roosterfoot said,
the mountain is called Camelback. The city is called Phoenix.
The fiery man laughed, a booming sound like thunder.
Phoenix, how appropriate. And the desert so much like home. All it needs now is to be scoured of life. The desert should be a sterile place, don't you think?
Oh, yes, my lord,
the toady agreed.
But what of the other four?
One is already entombed,
the fiery man said.
The second is weak. She will be easily manipulated. That leaves only two, and they will be dealt with soon enough.
How?
The toady asked. The fiery man glowed brighter.
You are an inquisitive little tadpole, aren't you?
He pointed at the toad, and the poor creature's skin began to steam.
No!
The toady begged.
No!
I could hardly watch. I don't want to describe it. But if you've heard what happens when cruel kids pour salt on snails, you'll have a pretty good idea of what happened to the toady. Soon, there was nothing left. Roosterfoot took a nervous step back. I couldn't blame him.
We will build my temple here,
the fiery man said, as if nothing had happened.
This mountain shall serve as my place of worship. When it is complete, I will summon the greatest storm ever known. I will cleanse everything. Everything.
Yes, my lord, Roosterfoot agreed quickly. And if I may suggest, my lord, to increase your power.
The creature bowed and scraped and moved forward as if he wanted to whisper in the fiery man's ear. Just when I thought Roosterfoot was going to become fried chicken for sure, he said something to the fiery dude that I couldn't make out, and the fiery dude burned brighter.
Excellent. If you can do this, you will be rewarded. If not,
I understand, my lord.
Go then,
the fiery man said.
Unleash our forces. Start with the long necks. That should soften them up. Collect the younglings and bring them to me. I want them alive, before they have time to learn their powers. Do not fail me.
No, lord.
Phoenix,
the fiery man mused.
I like that very much.
He swept his hand across the horizon as if he were imagining the city in flames.
Soon I will rise from your ashes. It will be a lovely birthday present.
I woke with my heart pounding, back in my own body. I felt hot as if the fiery guy were starting to burn me. Then I realized that there was a cat on my chest. Muffin stared at me, her eyes half closed.
Meow.
How did you get in? I muttered. I sat up, and for a second I wasn't sure where I was. Some hotel in another city? I almost called for my dad. And then I remembered. Yesterday, the museum, the sarcophagus. It all crashed down on me so hard I could barely breathe. Stop, I told myself. You don't have time for grief. And this is going to sound weird, but the voice in my head almost sounded like a different person. Older, stronger. Either that was a good sign, or I was going crazy.
Remember what you saw, the voice said. He's after you. You have to be ready.
I shivered. I wanted to believe I'd just had a bad dream, but I knew better. I'd been through too much in the last day to doubt what I'd seen. Somehow, I'd actually left my body while I slept. I'd been to Phoenix, thousands of miles away. The fiery dude was there. I hadn't understood much of what he'd said, but he'd talked about sending his forces to capture the younglings. Gee, wonder who that could be. Muffin jumped off the bed and sniffed at the ivory headrest, looking up at me as if she were trying to tell me something.
You can have it, I told her. It's uncomfortable.
She butted her head against it and stared at me accusingly.
Meow!
Whatever, cat. I got up and showered. When I tried to get dressed, I found that my old clothes had disappeared in the night. Everything in the closet was my size, but way different than what I was used to. Baggy drawstring pants and loose shirts, all plain white linen, and robes for cold weather. Kind of what the fellaheen, the peasants in Egypt, wear. It wasn't exactly my style. Sadie likes to tell me that I don't have a style. She complains that I dress like I'm an old man. Button-down shirt, slacks, dress shoes. Okay, maybe. But here's the thing. My dad had always drilled into my head that I had to dress my best. I remember the first time he explained it to me. I was 10. We were on our way to the airport in Athens, and it was like 112 degrees outside, and I was complaining that I wanted to wear shorts and a t-shirt. Why couldn't I be comfortable? We weren't going anywhere important that day, just traveling. My dad put his hand on my shoulder. Carter, you're getting older. You're an African-American man. People will judge you more harshly, and so you must always look impeccable. That isn't fair, I insisted. Fairness does not mean everyone gets the same, Dad said. Fairness means everyone gets what they need, and the only way to get what you need is to make it happen yourself. Do you understand? I told him I didn't, but still I did what he asked, like caring about Egypt and basketball and music, like traveling with only one suitcase. I dressed the way Dad wanted me to because Dad was usually right. In fact, I'd never known him to be wrong. Until the night at the British Museum. Anyway, I put on the linen clothes from the closet. The slipper shoes were comfortable, though I doubted they'd be much good to run in. The door to Sadie's room was open, but she wasn't there. Thankfully, my bedroom door wasn't locked anymore. Muffin joined me, and we walked downstairs, passing a lot of unoccupied bedrooms on the way. The mansion could have easily slept 100 people, but instead it felt empty and sad. Down in the great room, Hufu the baboon sat on the sofa with a basketball between his legs and a chunk of strange-looking meat in his hands. It was covered in pink feathers. ESPN was on the television, and Hufu was watching highlights from the games the night before. Hey, I said, though I felt a little weird talking to him. Lakers win? Hufu looked at me and patted his basketball like he wanted a game.
Ah! Ah!
He had a pink feather hanging from his chin, and the sight made my stomach do a slow roll.
Yeah, I said. We'll play later, okay?
I could see Sadie and Amos out on the terrace, eating breakfast by the pool. It should have been freezing out there, but the fire pit was blazing, and neither Amos nor Sadie looked cold. I headed their way, then hesitated in front of the statue of Thoth. In the daylight, the bird-headed god didn't look quite so scary. Still, I could swear those beady eyes were watching me expectantly. What had the fiery guy said last night?
Something about catching us before we learned our powers. It sounded ridiculous, but for a moment I felt a surge of strength, like the night before when I'd opened the front door just by raising my hand. I felt like I could lift anything, even this 30-foot-tall statue if I wanted to. In a kind of trance, I stepped forward. Muffin meowed impatiently and butted my foot. The feeling dissolved. "You're right," I told the cat. "Stupid idea." Besides, I could smell breakfast now. French toast, bacon, hot chocolate. And I couldn't blame Muffin for being in a hurry. I followed her out to the terrace.
"Ah, Carter," Amos said. "Merry Christmas, my boy. Join us."
"About time," Sadie grumbled. "I've been up for ages." But she held my eyes for a moment, like she was thinking the same thing I was. Christmas. We hadn't spent a Christmas morning together since Mom died. I wondered if Sadie remembered how we used to make God's Eye decorations out of yarn and popsicle sticks. Amos poured himself a cup of coffee. His clothes were similar to those he'd worn the day before, and I had to admit the guy had style. His tailored suit was made of blue wool. He wore a matching fedora, and his hair was freshly braided with dark blue lapis lazuli, one of the stones the Egyptians often used for jewelry. Even his glasses matched. The round lenses were tinted blue. A tenor sax rested on a stand near the fire pit, and I could totally picture him playing out here, serenading the East River. As for Sadie, she was dressed in a white linen pajama outfit like me, but somehow she'd managed to keep her combat boots. She'd probably slept with them on. She looked pretty comical, with the red-streaked hair and the outfit, but since I wasn't dressed any better, I could hardly make fun of her.
Amos? I asked. You didn't have any pet birds, did you? Hufu's eating something with pink feathers.
Amos sipped his coffee. Sorry if that disturbed you. Hufu's very picky. He only eats foods that end in O. Doritos, burritos, flamingos.
I blinked. Did you say...
Carter?
Sadie warned. She looked a little queasy, like she'd already had this conversation.
Don't ask.
Okay, I said, not asking.
Please, Carter, help yourself.
Amos waved toward a buffet table piled high with food.
Then we can get started with the explanations.
I didn't see any flamingo on the buffet table, which was fine by me, but there was just about everything else. I snagged some pancakes with butter and syrup, some bacon, and a glass of OJ. Then I noticed movement in the corner of my eye. I glanced at the swimming pool. Something long and pale was gliding just under the surface of the water. I almost dropped my plate.
Is that...
A crocodile, Amos confirmed. For good luck. He's albino, but please don't mention that. He's sensitive.
His name is Philip of Macedonia, Sadie informed me. I wasn't sure how Sadie was taking this all so calmly, but I figured if she wasn't freaking out, I shouldn't either.
That's a long name, I said.
He's a long crocodile, Sadie said.
Oh, and he likes bacon.
To prove her point, she tossed a piece of bacon over her shoulder. Philip lunged out of the water and snapped up the treat. His hide was pure white, and his eyes were pink. His mouth was so big he could have snapped up an entire pig.
He's quite harmless to my friends, Amos assured me. In the old days, no temple would be complete without a lake full of crocodiles. They are powerful magic creatures.
Right, I said. So the baboon, the crocodile... Any other pets I should know about?
Amos thought for a moment.
Visible ones? Nope, I think that's it.
I took a seat as far from the pool as possible. Muffin circled my legs and purred. I hoped she had enough sense to stay away from magic crocodiles named Philip. So, Amos, I said between bites of pancake. Explanations?
Yes, he agreed. Where to start?
Our dad, Sadie suggested. What happened to him?
Amos took a deep breath.
Julius was attempting to summon a god,
Unfortunately, it worked.
It was kind of hard to take Amos seriously, talking about summoning gods while he spread butter on a bagel.
Any god in particular? I asked casually. Or did he just order a generic god?
Sadie kicked me under the table. She was scowling as if she actually believed what Amos was saying.
Amos took a bite of bagel. There are many Egyptian gods, Carter, but your dad was after one in particular.
He looked at me meaningfully. Osiris, I remembered. When Dad was standing in front of the Rosetta Stone, he said, "Osiris, come." But Osiris is a legend. He's make-believe.
I wish that were true.
Amos stared across the East River at the Manhattan skyline, gleaming in the morning sun.
The ancient Egyptians were not fools, Carter. They built the pyramids. They created the first great nation-state. Their civilization lasted thousands of years.
Yeah, I said, and now they're gone.
Amos shook his head. A legacy that powerful does not disappear. Next to the Egyptians, the Greeks and Romans were babies. Our modern nations, like Great Britain and America, blinks of an eye. The very oldest root of civilization, at least of Western civilization, is Egypt. Look at the pyramid on the dollar bill. Look at the Washington Monument, the world's largest Egyptian obelisk. Egypt is still very much alive. And so, unfortunately, are her gods.
Come on, I argued. I mean, even if I believe there's a real thing called magic, believing in ancient gods is totally different. You're joking, right? But as I said it, I thought about the fiery guy in the museum, the way his face had shifted between human and animal, and the statue of Thoth, how its eyes had followed me.
Carter, Amos said, the Egyptians would not have been stupid enough to believe in imaginary gods. The beings they described in their myths are very, very real. In the old days, the priests of Egypt would call upon these gods to channel their power and perform great feats. That is the origin of what we now call magic. Like many things, magic was first invented by the Egyptians. Each temple had a branch of magicians called the House of Life. Their magicians were famed throughout the ancient world.
And you're an Egyptian magician.
Amos nodded. So was your father. You saw it for yourself last night. I hesitated. It was hard to deny my dad had done some weird stuff at the museum. Some stuff that looked like magic.
But he's an archaeologist, I said stubbornly.
That's his cover story. You'll remember that he specialized in translating ancient spells, which are very difficult to understand, unless you work magic yourself.
Our family, the Cain family, has been part of the House of Life almost since the beginning. And your mother's family is almost as ancient.
The Fausts?
I tried to imagine Grandma and Grandpa Faust doing magic, but unless watching rugby on TV and burning cookies was magical, I couldn't see it.
They had not practiced magic for many generations, Amos admitted. Not until your mother came along, but yes, a very ancient bloodline.
Sadie shook her head in disbelief. So now Mum was magic too. Are you joking?
No jokes, Amos promised. The two of you, you combine the blood of two ancient families, both of which have a long, complicated history with the gods. You are the most powerful Cain children to be born in many centuries.
I tried to let that sink in. At the moment, I didn't feel powerful. I felt queasy. You're telling me our parents secretly worshipped animal-headed gods? I asked.
Not worshipped, Amos corrected. By the end of the ancient times, Egyptians had learned that their gods were not to be worshipped. They are powerful beings, primeval forces, but they are not divine in the sense one might think of God. They are created entities,
like mortals, only much more powerful. We can respect them, fear them, use their power, or even fight them to keep them under control.
Fight gods? Sadie interrupted.
Constantly, Amos assured her. But we don't worship them. Toth taught us that.